Dr. Franklin. But no René Peter Casseroy. He's vanished. Evan sat down with his oatmeal over the stack of printouts. I'll find him. If you do, Van Sciver will be waiting. Like you said, he's already shown he can track René. He cracked his encryption once, he'll do it again. Jack shook off his boots. He'll spring a trap on you. I'll spring a trap on his trap. Jack settled into the chair opposite. He always sat still so as to limit any information given up by nonverbal tells. As a kid, Evan had learned the same from him, and from an interrogation specialist who'd wrapped his knuckles with a metal file every time he made a hand gesture. He and Jack faced each other now, paralyzed grand masters contemplating their next move. "How did you get out of that parking structure?" Evan asked. "I stumbled from the rear stairwell right after you. I had a man in the area. He picked me up half dead. Got me to an old friend at Walter Reed. I woke up, stitched back together." Evan struggled to get his head around it. Jack must have had a smoke contingency also. A plan to disappear. Stashed papers and hidden accounts and a cabin in the Alleghenies. 8 years. 8 years. "So those men I killed that night," Evan said. "The men who shot you. They were Van Sciver's men?" "Yes." "How many are there?" Jack looked at him blankly. "Orphans," Evan said. "From what I can glean, only a half dozen or so left under Van Sciver's control," Jack said. "It's hard to get a precise count because, you know, orphans." "Van Sciver's hunting down those of us who got out. Those of us who were deemed higher risk." "He's hunting some more than others," Jack said pointedly.
"They're neutralizing us."
"I know," Jack said. "I've been working sub rosa, helping the ones who need it most."
"You always knew. Even way back when, before you met me in that parking structure. You sent me the fake assignment to kill Van Sciver because you knew I'd refuse and go to ground. You knew I'd never kill one of my own. It was a play."
Jack broke the mannequin standoff, rubbing his eyes.
"It was more complicated than that. Van Sciver was tasked with killing you. If you'd found out, you would have destroyed everyone in your path."
"Yes." "The directive came from the highest level. You would have tried to kill your way right up the chain."
"Yes."
"You would have died.
Even you, Evan."
"I would have died for the truth instead of running from a lie. That's what you did to me. 8 years I've been running from that goddamn parking lot."
"8 years you've been alive."
"That's all that matters to you?"
"Yes."
Jack brought his fist down on the table, making the bowl jump.
"That's all that matters to me."
"I thought I killed you. I forced you to break cover to meet me."
"I told you it wasn't your fault. I told you it was my choice to meet you. I told you it doesn't matter what you said. It matters what happened."
"I knew you'd never run. Not as long as you thought I was alive. At some point you'd stick your head up, make contact with me, and they would get you."
"Like you did now?"
"I found out you were in trouble, and I moved heaven and earth to get to you. You're still a son to me. Look at me. You're still my son."
"Do you have any idea what I've lived with?"
"How about what I bear?" Jack said. "Taking you from that foster home, stripping you of human warmth, putting you in harm's way to do harm. I dragged you into all this. I wanted you to get out. I wanted you to have a chance."
"At what?"
"At a life." Jack flared a hand angrily around the cabin. "That isn't this. A wife. Maybe even kids. I tried to free you. I didn't think you'd scurry right back to it. Assassin for the people. He tapped his palm on the table, a judge's gavel. That is what you do now, isn't it? Freelance jobs. For others. People who can't...
You've been keeping tabs on me?
From afar, Jack said. I couldn't let you go. I could never let you go. I know you can't see it this way right now. But it was a sacrifice what I did.
A sacrifice.
Jack firmed at Evan's tone. You've never been a father. Evan felt the pulse fluttering his neck.
A father? You weren't my father. I wasn't a son to you. I was a weapon. You shaped me into what you needed and used me until I was used up.
Jack stiffened. The skin around his eyes shifted, and for an awful moment Evan thought he might cry. Jack cleared his throat. You know that's not true. However angry you are, you know that's not true.
I have been paying penance, Evan said, for the blood on my hands, including yours.
Jack sagged back in his chair.
I couldn't risk losing you, Evan. Not after I lost Clara. You swore. You swore you'd never lie to me. It was the one thing I could count on. The one solid thing I could trust in the world. You don't know what my first 12 years were like. In that home. In all the homes. You. You were the one thing I could ever count on.
I'm sorry.
Fuck you.
Evan stood and stuffed the stack of printouts inside his jacket. He grabbed the cash and the fake license and walked out. For a long time, Jack sat in his chair, staring at the empty seat across from him. His breathing grew harder. He raised a hand and pressed it over his mouth. Tears forded his knuckles, spotting the rough wood of the table. He did not make a sound. 62. That gnawing feeling. The boy's phone number, a 301 area code, was branded on Evan's brain. It had guttered across the cracked screen of the roam zone only a few times, but he'd committed it to memory. He turned the 10 digits over now in his head, as familiar as a remnant from a dream. Bouncing along the bitter interstate in the passenger seat of the semi he'd hitched a ride with, he snatched a pen from the cup holder and jotted down the number on the back of his hand. He stared at the scrawled digits. That same feeling gnawed at him again. That he'd seen the number before.
You all right, bud?
The trucker asked, exhaling the smell of Red Man tobacco. Fine, thanks.
Where do you want I should drop you?
A sign flashed overhead as they crossed Baltimore city limits. Anywhere's fine.
You from around here?
I guess I am.
Well, the trucker said, welcome home.
Evan hopped out at the next gas station. He found a payphone at the side, right between the bathrooms. He called the only person left on the planet he could trust to deliver what he needed. It rang 3 times before the gruff voice answered.
Crazy daisies, flowers, something for every occasion.
Evan said, I need a backpack cutting torch, an H&K MP5 SD, a compressed air grappling hook strong enough to take the weight of a jungle penetrator, and a skiff with 250-horsepower engines to meet me in Daytona Beach by tomorrow at noon. I'll tell you a location. I don't want to see any faces, just the stuff waiting at a pier. There was a long pause.
This, Tommy Stojak said, can be arranged.
Good.
Anything else?
Yeah. Evan smirked. Advil.
You going full Somali pirate on me?
I assure you, Evan said, it's for a good cause.
Good cause or not, you're going to have sticker shock. I have to work it cross-country. Plus, you know, discretion. I got a hook at Camp Blanding. He's our people. Something like this, I can't just use some clown for hire. After all, you never know who's who in the zoo.
Just tell me the price,
and I'll pay it.
Evan hung up. Now, on to the boy. He hauled up the tattered yellow pages dangling from a security cord and searched out the nearest cyber cafe. There was one a few miles away. $4 per hour. Terminals clean wiped after every logout. We accept Bitcoin. Cabs were scarce, so we hoofed it, walking fast enough to stave off the cold. The chill crept into his shoulder, and he had to remind himself not to hunch to favor it. The tendon muscles and skin had to stretch in order to heal properly. At last, he stepped into the Java-scented shop, peeled 100 off the roll Jack had set aside for him, and requested a workstation and a universal phone charger. He plugged the roam zone into a desktop outlet, fired up the computer, and ran a quick search. Reverse phone number directories proliferated. He found a free one and keyed in the kid's number. Sandwiched between various pop-up ads was the result. No record of this number exists. Evan stared at the screen, his discomfort growing. One workstation over, two teenage girls laughed at a YouTube video, all gleaming white teeth and vanilla-scented hairspray. Evan called up a second directory, keyed in the number again, and waited as the loading bar filled. Number last used in 1996. He stared at the screen, his stomach roiling. How the hell had the boy called him from a line that had been retired 20 years ago? The previously associated address was available provided he endure a 15-second car commercial. His fingers drummed the desktop as he waited through a jingle promising 0% APR for 72 months. That gnawing feeling made some more headway, chewing through his assumptions. He glanced nervously over at the roam zone plugged into the outlet by the mousepad. No lights, no bars, no indication that it was charging. Slowly, he reached across, picked up the shattered case. He unplugged the charger, plugged it in again. Nothing happened. The phone wasn't just out of juice. It was completely smashed, an untenable mess of broken glass, fragmented circuit board, and obliterated SIM card. It had never worked. Not since Renee had crushed it underfoot that first morning Evan had woken up in the chalet. In the harsh light of the Baltimore day, it seemed painfully obvious. A phone that withstood a Godzilla stomping, that never ran out of juice, that magically got reception in a far-flung valley under a snow-thickened sky. Evan thought about how the gas had poured through the heating vent, tipping him into a drugged stupor. The blood loss hallucinations he'd experienced at the end as he staggered for the summit. The unconscious pulling strings, opening trapdoors, spinning its webs. Of course. A sheen of sweat covered Evan's body. On the computer, the car commercial ended, the link to the address springing up. Dazed, he dropped the ruined roam zone into the blue recycle bucket under the desk and swung his attention back to the monitor. He felt drunk with disbelief. His hand reached for the mouse, clicked the link. An instant before the fresh screen came up, the truth dawned on him, setting his skin tingling. He knew what it would show, even before it loaded. An East Baltimore address. He knew it well. 63. The People No One Wants. The battered row house leaned against its neighbors, the whole lot of them tall and narrow and crooked, drunkards staggering arm in arm from a bar. The flaking paint was a different shade of green now. Same front window that the pack of kids used to peer through when the mystery man made his mysterious appearances. Same basketball courts across with the same chain-link fence surrounding the same cracked asphalt. Same handball walls, layered with new graffiti. The Lafayette Courts projects that used to loom in the background were long gone, replaced with a health clinic. Satellite dishes perched pigeon-like on balconies and rooftops. A licensed marijuana dispensary now squatted on the plot that once housed the apartment building that had gone up in smoke when Jalila's Nana dozed off smoking a blunt. Evan turned back to the dilapidated row house. Bumblebee hazard tape crisscrossed the front door, orange cones lining the sidewalk in front. Bulldozers and backhoes lingered in the wings, construction workers chewing sandwiches, shooting the shit. Flyers fluttered from telephone poles, announcing that the building was slated for demolition. The street had been blocked off. A crowd gathered at the Sawhorses, as crowds did in East Baltimore. The same faces, on different bodies. Crack-ravaged cheeks, coyote eyes, elaborate press-on nails. A few industrious souls rolled coolers across the chipped concrete, selling bottled water and Doritos to the spectators for a buck a pop. Dinner and a show. Evan walked over to a worker crouched near a spool of cable. Mind if I take a closer look?
Not safe, pal. The boom's kicking off in a half hour. Don't want to get your hair blown back, you feel me?
I feel you. The worker swept an arm at the piano key row of facades.
I wish we could take down the whole lot of them. You wouldn't believe what a shithole the place was.
What was it?
Housing for the elderly. And I use the term loosely. Housing, that is. My cousin had his mother-in-law here, said it was worse than the dog pound. Asbestos in the ceiling, mold in the drywall, rats beneath the floorboards. Used to be some kind of facility for retards, and before that, a foster home for boys.
I'd heard something about that.
All the people no one wants. They cram them in, let them rot. It's a crime, really. Not that anyone gives a shit to do anything about it.
Evan stared at that front window, saw his own 12-year-old face pressed against the pane with all the others. Danny and Jamal and Andre. Tyrell, who caught shit because his sister was a whore. Ramon, so skinny his hips could barely hold up his stolen cavaricis.
Look, man, I'm sorry, but you gotta clear out before my supervisor comes over.
Evan nodded and withdrew. He circled the block, cut through the glass-strewn alley next to Mr. Wong's ancient dry cleaner, where they used to loot the dish of Tootsie Pops every chance they got. The back of the row house appeared at the alley's end. In his memory, the rear slat fence towered overhead, a castle wall. Now it came up to his chest. Resting his hands on the top, he looked down onto the stamp of crumbling concrete that passed for a backyard. When he hopped over, his shoulder was none too happy about it. Hazard tape blocked the back windows and door. The kitchen pane had been shattered, shards poking up from the frame like teeth. He peered through the mouth. Explosive charges had been placed on the walls and ceiling to make the building implode. It would collapse in on itself, like so many of the lives lived here. Carefully, Evan pulled himself through and climbed down off the sink. Piles of beer cans, a heap of stained blankets, cigarette butts worming up from a pickle jar lid. The place had been abandoned for a time, no doubt in preparation for the demolition. But the bones were the same. There was the ghost of the kitchen table, where plates slopped with generic, no-brand mac and cheese had conveyor belted across the days and nights, a neon orange blur. I'm trapped here. There's never enough food. Here the counter-edge Danny shoved Andre into, earning him 7 stitches across the forehead. I don't want this life. I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask for any of it. And across in the living room, the spot where Papa Z reclined in his armchair, remote in hand, Coors nestled in his crotch. No one cares. If you don't exist, then it doesn't matter. Right? Evan walked over and stepped on the floorboards 2 feet inside the threshold. Sure enough, they gave off a creak. He and the boys had done a lot of sneaking in and out of the Pride House group home. Staring at the ragged carpet of the living room, Evan saw a specter of the scene that had played out between these walls so many years ago. The mystery man talking to Papa Z about the boys, weighing pros and cons, a chef at a butcher counter, and Evan and the boys spying from down the hall, elbowing and whispering, and wondering what the hell it all meant. In the hall, the dent cord wrapping an exposed beam in the mold-eaten drywall was a few inches off the stress point. Probably wouldn't make much of a difference. Next to the gaping hole, the wallpaper seam bubbled out. Evan grabbed a lifted tab and peeled it away, revealing a dagger of the old wallpaper. An awful plaid pattern that Tyrell had christened White Man Pants. Evan stared a moment, the memory vibrating his cells. Then on down the hall to the bedroom he'd lived in for 2.5 years, a submarine birthing area crammed with bodies. Closing his eyes, he pictured the bunk beds lined side to side like livestock pens. "You should see how they keep us here. Like cattle, all lined up." He stepped inside the room. It smelled the same. Rot, dust, desperation. He crossed to where his mattress used to lie on the floor. The other foster kids would trample him half inadvertently when they hopped out of their bunks. He looked at the ceiling, found the crack that forked into a lightning bolt. The one he'd gaze up at in the dark like it was some kind of wishing star, and wonder who he was. "Where are you from?" "I don't know. I don't remember." "Do you have a family? Parents?"
I don't know. It's been so long."
Machinery revved up outside. A jackhammer screamed into asphalt. Gears clanked. A bulldozer lurching forward, blade lifted like a metal claw.
"Will you help me? Will you?"
Evan had sworn a promise to his 12-year-old self. "I'll get to you." Here he was. But what did he want? The echo of the voice came again.
"You have to remember me."
He walked to the doorframe, carved into the wood with Papa Z's trusty pocket knife, were the boys' height markers. The undertaking had lasted one summer month, until it became clear that given turnover and growth spurts, the notches would chew up the entire jam. Evan ran the pads of his fingers over the nicks and the carved initials next to them. There at the top, the highest by a good 6 inches, were three letters. CVS. Charles Van Sciver. Then Ramon. The others descended in a cluster, the initials overlapping, turning the wood into a cross-hatched mess. Way down at the bottom, as far below the scrum as Van Sciver's was above, there was a solitary notch.
"It has to be you."
Evan had to crouch. There it was. The E still holding on after the years, though the initial of his original surname had long been effaced. How small he'd been. He'd known it back then, of course, but he'd never let himself recognize it. He'd been too busy scrapping and fighting for his life, for his sanity, for a way out. He had neither size nor strength, so he'd had to rely on grit and tenacity. Only these he could control. Everything else he had to ball up and cram down deep inside himself.
"It has to be you." That nick, set apart so far below, made it undeniable. His vulnerability, his powerlessness, his loneliness. What had he hoped for back then? What kind of future had he dreamed of when he'd stared up at the lightning fork crack in the ceiling?
It had been visions of Wilson Combat 1911 pistols and encrypted virtual private network tunnels and trauma surgeries to patch himself back together. Drinking vodka at his counter, sharing each night with a wall of herbs and a city view. Sleeping inside a penthouse prison cell of his own making. He'd been desperate enough to grab the first ticket out. Had he stayed behind, he'd be in prison by now, long dead, or jackaled out from the streets or drugs. Jack Johns had saved his life as surely as when he'd swooped in on that Blackhawk. And yet Evan hadn't looked back since climbing into Jack's dark sedan as a scared 12-year-old kid. Hadn't reconsidered whether the tooth and claw skills that had gotten him out of East Baltimore were still the best ones to carry him forward. When he'd driven off with Jack, the world had yawned open to him like a summer day. But a part of him had been put on pause, as stalled as a stuck DVD. He fought his way back to that scared little kid, pried open the rusty hatches, and looked at what was locked inside. It was hard to acknowledge. Harder yet to feel. And yet, crouching here in a slant of afternoon light, filtered through a filthy window, he felt it. This part, he wasn't very good at. It has to be you. He wiped his mouth. His throat felt parched, his voice husky. Okay, he said. I see you. On his way out, he adjusted the charge wrapping the beam in the hall. Standing in the crowd a few minutes later, another anonymous body jockeying for position behind the sawhorses, he watched the building crumble. A slow-motion cascade, all that rot and mold collapsing inward until nothing remained but a heap and a cloud.
You have to come.
I got here. He thought. I promised I would. One moment, he was in the heat of the crowd. The next, he was gone. This part, he was good at. 64. The Slender Man. The Slender Man always got excited as the hour neared. All the cues for arousal were there. The big cranes, the smell of diesel, the containers lined up like giant dominoes. It meant that soon, he would claim his prize. Entering Jacksport, he felt like one of Pavlov's dogs, salivating at the bell. His heartbeat quickened as he took in the sights, breathed the muggy wet of the St. John's River, which crept by in the background as dark and lazy as lava. He was perspiring through his dress shirt. His town car purred along the roadway. He sat in the back, a bottle of champagne icing in a bucket. It was a celebration 16 days in the making. Resting on the seat next to him were a set of fleece-lined wrist cuffs and a ball gag. Also, a chilled bottle of Fiji. Hector Contrell would have arranged nourishment for the journey, but the Slender Man found that they generally arrived parched. His bodyguard and driver, Donald, knew not to speak, not to say anything that might break the spell of this magical time. The drive up, you see, even this was part of the foreplay. Donald turned off the main road to a rear cargo zone, the designated area where a series of under-the-table payments had determined that intermodular container 78653-B812 would be sent down. That was the beauty of it. Most everyone who worked at a port took bribes. No one had any idea what the container held. It was there, waiting, placed alone on an apron of asphalt. Donald got out first, his coat jacket shifting around his bulk, pulled tight across the holster. The slender man emerged and took a moment there in the midnight silence. He tilted his head back and drew in a deep breath of fresh air. It was a starless night, the sky an impenetrable sheet of black, save for the moon, which beamed with an intensity that reminded him of the comic book illustrations of his youth. He recalled the photographs of her from the online catalog and reminded himself to lower his expectations. They didn't always arrive in the best shape, but once they were cleaned and rested, they were usually restored to their previous condition, good for several months. Even then he could most often fetch a decent price selling them used. For people with lower standards, there was still value to be extracted. The slender man nodded at Donald, who produced a key, moved forward and fussed with the massive cargo door lock. Then he swung out the leverage handles, the lock rods clanking in their holds. He stepped back, a magician revealing the prestige. After so much planning, the theatrics were essential. Nothing could shatter the mood. As the doors creaked open, Donal eased farther back out of the sightline and stood beside the slender man, leaning against the driver's door with his hands folded. This was the slender man's favorite part, when he let them out of the dark box they'd been living in for weeks. He was their keeper, their owner, their god. But this time, something was different. The inside, it wasn't pitch black. A rod of light dropped from the roof of the container unit. Had Contrell installed a light for her journey? The slender man blinked but could make out nothing in the darkness beyond. It looked like a spotlight on a stage. The aesthetics rather suited him. "Don't be shy, my love," he said. "Step forward." A rustling issued from the shadows, a form emerging. She was bigger than he would have thought. Broad-shouldered. She was also a he, and the he was holding what appeared to be a 9mm submachine gun of German design. The slender man felt his throat clutch when he realized that the light on the ceiling wasn't a spotlight at all. It was the golden light of the moon, shining through a hole that had been cut in the top of container 78653-B812. In the gleam of the muzzle flare, he saw the actual Ms. Siegler crouched in the back corner of the container behind the man, hair matted down across her eyes. Beside him, Donald danced a little jig, the rounds jerking his limbs this way and that. There came a moment of silence, a curl of cordite rising from the muzzle, during which the slender man grappled with the fact that the carefully curated mood was, in fact, shattered. He tried to say something, but the sound he forced through his dry throat was an inhuman croak. He'd never known that terror could feel like this, a physical sensation running through every vein, inhabiting every cell, threatening to explode from the core of you straight through your skin. The silence stretched out longer yet as the barrel drifted casually to face him, the bore waxing into a full moon to match the one above. And then he sensed his body flying back against the side of the town car, the safety glass of the windows cascading around him, and he tried to make out the face of the man behind the weapon that was tearing him to shreds. The face was nothing but a silhouette, as black as the darkness that surged up and claimed him. 65. Fragile Little Bond. The cab swept into the porte cochere, delivering Evan to Castle Heights. He spilled out of the car, raw from pain and 2 days of grueling travel, his bedraggled appearance undercutting the grand entrance.
When he reached for the heavy glass door to the lobby, a dagger of pain shot across his ribs. He lowered his arm and staggered a half step to the side, nearly colliding with Ida Rosenbaum of 6G. The wizened woman, crusted with makeup and built like a fire hydrant, glowered up at him.
"Careless, aren't you?"
"Sorry, ma'am. I'm just..."
"You just what?"
He tried to let his right arm hang normally.
"Just a little jet-lagged."
"Jet-lagged? Had a rough business trip, did you?"
He ducked his head to hide the band of skin on his neck that still bore scabs from the shock collar.
"You could say that.
My Herb, may he rest in peace, worked his fingers to the bone and never complained a day in his life. We knew what hardship was, our generation."
"Yes, ma'am."
"We weren't kvetchers."
"No, ma'am."
She clutched her purse to her jacket, a shade of red not found in nature. He realized she was waiting for him to open the lobby door for her. To avoid doing a close-quarters pirouette, he had to reach for the handle with his right hand. He braced himself, opened the door through the fireworks exploding inside his shoulder, and smiled with gritted teeth. With a waft of rosewater, she passed beneath his arm, and with great relief, he released the door and stepped into the cool air of the lobby.
"Heaven smoke!"
As he pivoted at the sound of the raspy voice, Peter collided into him with a hug. Wincing, Evan patted his back. The boy wore true blue jeans with a toy gun and holster on one hip and a lasso on the other. A shoved-back cowboy hat completed the John Wayne vibe.
"You like my Halloween costume?"
Evan gave a nod, shuffle-stepping for the elevator. He needed to get upstairs and peel off the dressings before he bled through. "Can't beat the classics." When he looked up, Mia stood right there, holding an empty pillowcase.
"Hi, Evan."
"No costume for you?"
"This is my costume."
She flared her arms theatrically. "It's called Single Mom Without the Time Management Skills to Comb Her Hair." He caught himself noticing the birthmark kissing her temple, the way her curly chestnut hair fell across her shoulders, and reined in his focus. "Elevator. Upstairs. Now."
"Haven't seen you in a while," Mia said.
"What mysterious things have you been up to?"
"Too mysterious to recount," Evan said.
She took him in more closely, her forehead twisting with concern. Peter tugged at Mia's sleeve.
"Can he come over for dinner tonight instead of Ted?"
"Ted?
Can he? Mom, can he?"
Mia colored.
"No, honey."
Then, to Evan, "He's a friend." Evan gave another nod, took another step toward the safety of the elevator doors.
"Then can he go trick-or-treating with us?"
"Peter, I'm sure Mr. Smoke has better..."
"I'm going to shoot horse thieves and bad guys. You should totally come."
The toy gun was out of the holster, and Evan was staring at it, a hard edge of discomfort rising inside him, something he was unaccustomed to feeling in the floral-scented lobby of Castle Heights.
"I can't. What did you dress up as when you were a kid?"
I didn't really celebrate Halloween."
"Why not?"
Evan was 8 hours from his last dose of Advil, the pain starting to cramp his peripheral vision.
"Don't aim that gun at me."
His voice startled all three of them. Peter lowered the toy gun.
"You don't have to be mean."
"I wasn't being mean."
"Yes," Peter said.
"You were."
Mia slung an arm over Peter's shoulder.
"Come on, sweetheart. Let's get you some candy."
They withdrew. Evan stood a moment before turning to the elevators. By the time he got upstairs, the headache had crept down into his neck, meeting the fiery nerve lines shooting up from his shoulder. He went straight to the kitchen, tugged open the freezer drawer of his Sub-Zero, and assessed his options. A single bottle of Stolichnaya Elite remained. Triple distilled,
The vodka was purified through a freeze filtration process that dropped its temperature to 0 degrees to eliminate the impurities. He wasn't sure his arm could inflict the abuse he generally put a martini shaker through, so he poured 2 fingers over ice, palmed a trio of Advil, and took a sip. As crisp as it was clear, it struck him that his vodka indulgence was something like a purification ceremony. After all the blood and filth he'd waded through, he didn't drink to numb his senses. He drank to try to cleanse himself from the inside out. He pressed the frozen bottle to his shoulder. It stung. He let it. Leaning on the poured concrete of the center island, he glanced across at his vertical garden, the wall textured with herbs and plants. The mint was taking over, as it did. This wall, the sole splash of green amid the metals and grays, was his one stab at living with life. The attempt struck him as poignant and pathetic at the same time. I wanted you to get out. I wanted you to have a chance. At what? At a life that isn't this. He pushed away Jack's voice, exhaled through clenched teeth. Whatever Jack had hoped for him couldn't be worth as much as the sight of Allison Siegler being tended to by paramedics. Her shoulders had been hunched, and she'd started at the touch of the paramedics. But when she rose to walk to the ambulance, she'd stood tall. Unbroken. Evan had been across the St. John's River by then, watching from an unlit pier on the opposite bank. He took another sip, let the Stoli blaze a path through his insides. After the past couple weeks, he couldn't get his muscles to believe that it was safe to relax. The alarm was set, the front door barred, the windows armored. Even the walls here had been upgraded. Half-inch residential sheetrock replaced with 5 8/10 commercial grade, which provided better sound attenuation and more structural rigidity in the event that someone tried to breach the place. He considered how much of his life he'd spent bricking himself in. A wife. Maybe even kids. I tried to free you. I didn't think you'd scurry right back to it. What else did he know? For his entire adult life, he'd been one of those rough men standing ready in the night to visit violence on those who would do harm. A sentry willing to go up against the Hector Contrells and René Casseroys, the Asim al-Hakims and Tigran Sarkisians. If not him, then who? Maybe now that he'd been freed from the guilt of killing Jack, he'd be freed from seeking endless absolution for his sins. Freed from being the nowhere man. Which meant he could be someone. Someone real. He thought of Mia and Peter out in the neighborhood right now, going door to door, collecting Kit Kats and M&Ms. He downed the last of the vodka, studied the empty glass, trying to ratchet himself back to reality. He had to get a new roam zone up and running in the event Anna Resian had found the next client requiring his help. He owed her, and he owed whoever would call. Plus, René was out there, which meant Evan still had a job to do. As Evan sat here waxing philosophical over an empty tumbler, René was no doubt already laying the foundations for his next operation. Another kidnapping. The next gruesome medical lab. If Evan wanted to finish René, he'd have to beat the FBI to him while dodging Van Sciver and his attack dog orphans. He owed as much to Despy. She'd brought him a tire jack, and her entire family had been slaughtered for it.
I don't know how to live with this, she'd told him, with what I saw.
René was a devourer of lives. Evan couldn't let him continue, not with the wreckage he'd leave in his wake.
And yet, that birthmark, a kiss on Mia's temple,
Peter's charcoal eyes, his croaky voice. Evan washed the glass and then made his way down the hall, passing the empty brackets where the new katana was supposed to hang. Over the past few days, he'd learned to remove his bandages and undress with minimal pain. Standing naked at the threshold of the shower, he flashed back to that bathroom at the chalet, the floor sloping to a drain, bar of soap and a folded towel, prison toilet, trash can liner to the side. Of their own accord, his fingers had moved to his scabbed neck. He ducked into the warm stream. The first hit of water always stung the collarbone, but the burn quickly abated. He breathed hard, reminded himself that he was home. He was, he realized, barely holding it together. His weight tugged him to the side, the wall cool against his ribs. He let the hot water beat against his crown. At some point, autopilot clicked on, the rituals of survival keeping him in motion. He got out, toweled off, rebandaged. In his bedroom, he confronted the dresser, glaring at the bottom drawer with its false compartment bearing the blood-stained flannel. Jack's very own shroud of Turin. Evan carried Jack's shirt up the hall and across the great room to the freestanding fireplace, set it atop the pyre of cedar logs, and watched it burn. The coordinates by which he had charted the past 8 years, up in smoke. As matter turned to air, he recognized that his own misguided sorrow and guilt had coalesced in the stiff fabric, as much a part of the shirt as the dried blood staining it. Even after no trace of the flannel remained, he found himself standing before the flames. Returning to the bedroom, he pulled an unworn pair of dark jeans from the stack of duplicates. One drawer up were the fresh V-necked gray T-shirts, also neatly folded, also identical. A hinged wooden box in the closet held 4 Victorinox watch fobs, still in the package. He took one out, clipped it to his first belt loop on the left side. What did it say about him that he was so easily put back together? He'd long thought that it was a positive attribute, a testament to his durability. But now it felt artificial, unhuman. He was rebuildable, a snapped-together Lego toy. His well-stocked drawers reminded him of the mac-and-cheese meals of his childhood, an assembly belt existence from as far back as he could remember, and as far ahead as he could see. One mission would bleed into the next, until the inevitable. If not Van Sciver, someone else. Evan would get older. His reflexes would get slower. Sooner or later he'd be a half second too slow. Would he have balanced the books by then? And even if he had, would it make a difference? Not a train of thought an assassin should engage in. Exhaustion descended over him, a heavy cloud. That was it, then. He was tired. A good night's sleep would purge his brain of this existential nonsense. Heading back to the bathroom, he stepped through the hidden door in the water-beaded shower and into the vault. A Hardig storm case by the weapon lockers held a neat row of replacement Rome Zone phones, each nestled in black foam. He plucked one out, slotting in a new SIM card, then dropped into the chair before the bank of monitors burdening the sheet metal desk. A few clicks, and he'd switched the phone service to a company in Bahrain. He turned on the Rome Zone. No messages from Anoresian's referral. And plugged it into the desktop charger. An impulse grabbed him. With flying fingers, he called up Castle Heights internal security feeds, then zeroed in on the lens positioned by the 12th floor elevator. He rewound at 3x, the digital footage herky-jerky. There. A few minutes ago, the camera had captured Mia walking backward with a man down the hall. Reversing into the elevator, the doors zippering shut behind them.
she'd gone to meet him in the lobby. That seemed noteworthy. Evan clicked play, let the doors part, freeze-framed on the man. Ted. The guy looked pleasant enough. Rumpled hair, work casual clothes, black Chuck Taylors throwing in a dash of cool. A web designer or an advertising exec, maybe. He'd know how to barbecue. CrossFit gym membership, vacations to Maui, a peaceful, ordinary existence, work and play, and time to reflect. He thought of Mia's smile and wondered how dinner was going downstairs. With Ted. The Rome's Own perched in its charger, awaiting the next call from the next client. Evan stared at it with enmity. It wasn't just a phone. It was a collar and chain. For an instant, he let himself imagine what it would be like to be free of it. Plucked fresh from the living wall, basil, sage, and tomatoes sizzled atop the cooking eggs. With a dip of his wrist, Evan folded the omelet, completing the half circle, and then slid it onto a plate. He'd woken early, meditated, and stretched. He couldn't yet hang from the pull-up bar with his full weight, but if he tugged at it with his right hand, he could lengthen out the muscles of the arm. He'd required the jungle penetrator to bear him up the side of the Horizon Express, the cable attached to the grappling hook reeling him in on the deployed seat like a hooked fish. At the store this morning, he'd stocked up on the basics, eggs, cheese, vodka. Now he sat, ate, and enjoyed the view of downtown 12 miles to the east. The high-rises thrust up abruptly, a compact little skyline fit for a snow globe. He made his way to the vault, cocked back in his chair at his L-shaped desk, and reread every last word of the printouts he'd taken from Jack's cabin. They contained the starting points of the investigation into Rene Casseroy, the trails the FBI was currently running down. The crime scene photographs taken at the chalet seemed less useful, capturing the aftermath of the bizarre events. Bullet-riddled basement lab, barn with 2 G-wagons and a blue wrestling mat. Files spread across the Pakistani rug of the fourth-floor study, each one sporting a bright yellow evidence and property tag. Evan sent the papers to the side. It made no sense for him to follow the same tracks the FBI was. They had more resources and would be too far ahead. The question was, what did he know that the FBI didn't? He started with Renee's escape. Jack had mentioned that the Bureau was looking into helicopter flight logs, so either the agents were on Renee's heels already, or he'd covered his tracks. Renee didn't have to go in any one specified direction, which made it harder to... Evan stopped, excitement pulsing in his chest. Dex. Severed hand, lifted out by helicopter. His destination would have been set. A hospital. Not just a hospital. A hospital with a department of surgery and a helipad. The FBI had no idea what had gone down in the ballroom, so they wouldn't know to search for a patient missing a hand. A quick Google spin gave Evan only 3 contenders within a helicopter tank's distance of Chalet Savoir-Faire. To the databases. Whenever Evan did break-ins from his computers in the vault, he went through a string of anonymous proxies, remote services that allowed him to go in with 1 IP address and come out with another. He routed through Shanghai, then Johannesburg, bounced between a triptych of Scandinavian countries, then popped through Colombia and Moldova for good measure. He was ready to attack. Most hospitals relied on the Epic medical record system, which Evan knew well. In no time, he'd jimmied a few virtual back doors. The second hospital rang the cherries. A 6'5" male, 290 pounds, with a severed left hand had been admitted at 1:47 p.m.
on Sunday, October 23rd. Name given? Jonathan D-O-U-G-H. The record noted that the patient did not, or would not, speak. He'd been seen immediately by a vascular surgeon and taken directly to the O.R. He'd checked out early the next morning against medical advice. Payment had been made in cash. Evan scanned the discharge forms. Most of the personal information had been left blank. But there at the bottom, a phone number was given. Why would Dex, a mute, have a cell phone? Already Evan was reaching for his roam zone. He dialed. It rang. And again. A click as someone picked up. A heavy breath came across the receiver. Renee Casseroy, Evan said. You found the Easter egg I asked Dex to hide for you. I'm glad. I've been waiting for your call. It took Evan a moment to adjust to the sound of that voice again, especially here within the walls of his own place. He realized he was on his feet, pacing around the vault. Why's that? He asked. I wanted to talk to you. Set a few things straight. There's nothing you can say that will change what's coming. That's where I tend to think ahead. You see, given what I know of you, I thought you stood a reasonable chance of getting out of that valley alive. I don't know how you did it, but count me impressed. I've never had the opportunity to behold a specimen like you. I'm planning to give you another chance to behold me. That's what I assumed. Which is why I took out an insurance policy. Which is what? Despy. Evan stopped, pacing. You thought you were clever knocking out a few of my surveillance cameras. But did you really think we couldn't regulate you in that room? We had full audio. You should have heard yourself, pathetic and delusional, babbling into a broken phone, talking to whom? Who were you talking to, like your life depended on it? Myself. I guess you were. Renee laughed. But my favorite listening came from the snippets we picked up of your conversations with Despy. The woeful tale of her kidnapping, how we kept a loving eye on her parents, her sister. We listened to you two form your fragile little bond. I know you care about her. I know you'd be upset if any harm came to her. Evan was gripping the phone too hard, the tension radiating up into his right shoulder, fanning the flames. Yes, he said. I would. We have men in Despy's vicinity, watching her just as they did her sister, her parents. You're familiar with the work they did there? I am. She'll be left alone, if you leave me alone, Renee said. So decide if your need for revenge is worth her life. You've failed her once already. The brief pause was underscored by the faint hum of the connection. If I get the tiniest indication that you're within 100 miles of me, I will have her gutted. What makes you think I'll give you the tiniest indication? Evan said, and cut the line. 66. Banged up in all the right ways.
How'd it go? The Somali pirate routine. Tommy Stojak ambled across the cave of his armorer shop, passing warped speed loaders, cutting torches, a stray crate of anti-tank grenades with Cyrillic lettering on the shipping label. He reached into a jumble of Ares pistol frames stacked like chicken bones atop a pelican case. Each frame was a forging of aluminum, basically a solid piece of metal shaped like a gun. Evan said, "It went just fine."
You rescue the princess, slay the dragon?
Something like that. I came to